they told Puerto Rico the war was over. They did not tell the island who would decide its future. In 1998, power changed hands without the people changing their status. Spain left, the United States arrived, no vote, no seat at the table, no moment of consent. What followed was not freedom, it was transfer. From that moment forward, every major decision moved outward. Laws came from elsewhere. Wars were fought in other people's names. Taxes were paid without full representation. Citizenship arrived without choice. Democracy stopped short of the ballot box. We are told this is a relationship. We are told it is protection. We are told it is complicated. But for more than a century, Puerto Rico has lived under rules it cannot fully shape, leaders it cannot fully elect, and consequences it cannot fully escape. This is not a story about the past. This is about what happens when power never really leaves. Chapter 1, Transferred, Not Freed. Puerto Rico did not enter a new century by choice. It was carried into it. In 1898, war moved quickly through the Caribbean. Spain was weakened. The United States was expanding. Puerto Rico was not a battlefield for long. There were no decisive island-wide battles. There was no uprising that changed the outcome. The island was passed from one empire to another through negotiations held far away. No Puerto Rican delegation was invited. No consent was requested. The war ended on paper before it ended in reality. When Spain surrendered, Puerto Rico was not listed as a people to be consulted. It was listed as territory. Along with other possessions, it became part of a deal that treated land and population as assets. The language of the agreement spoke of transfer, not liberation. Sovereignty moved, the people stayed in place. The United States military arrived as administrators, not guests. Spanish authority was removed. Governors were appointed. Courts were reorganized. Laws were replaced. The island was now under a new flag, but not under its own control. The public messaging was careful. This was not described as conquest. It was framed as protection. Officials spoke of order, modernization, and opportunity. Puerto Rico was presented as unprepared for self-rule and in need of guidance. The empire did not describe itself as an empire. It described itself as a tutor. For many on the island, the change was disorienting. Spanish rule had been colonial, restrictive, and unequal, but it was also familiar. Language, law, and social structure were deeply rooted. Overnight, authority shifted to a system that spoke a different language and answered to a distant legislature. The rhythm of governance changed without warning. Puerto Rico had no standing in international law after the transfer. It could not sign treaties. It could not negotiate trade. It could not decide its own diplomatic future. These powers now belonged entirely to Washington. The island existed inside the system but outside its decision-making core. The military government ruled by decree. Local leaders could advise but not decide. Education was restructured to emphasize English, property laws were rewritten, economic rules were adjusted to align with mainland interests. None of this required island approval. We need to pause here and be precise. This was not accidental. This was design. The United States Congress debated Puerto Rico not as a future nation, but as a possession. The question was not whether Puerto Rico should govern itself. The question was how much autonomy could be allowed without threatening federal authority. The answer shifted over time, but the core assumptions stayed intact. Puerto Rico belonged to the United States, not the other way around. This created a legal contradiction that would define the next century. Puerto Rico was governed by federal law, but it was not treated as an equal part of the nation. The island existed in a category of its own, not foreign, not fully domestic, subject, but not sovereign. For the people living there, this ambiguity was not theoretical. It affected daily life. Policies changed without consultation. Taxes were collected without proportional representation. Military service could be required, even as political voice was limited. Power flowed in one direction. Some island leaders hoped the arrangement was temporary. They believed the transfer might lead to eventual independence or equal inclusion. Others feared that the lack of a clear path meant permanent suspension, a people caught between statuses with no timeline and no guarantees. Public debate on the island intensified. Newspapers questioned the meaning of the new rule. Civic organizations demanded clarity. What exactly was Puerto Rico now? A colony, a territory, a future state, a nation in waiting? The United States did not answer directly. Instead, Congress asserted its authority. It claimed the right to decide the island's fate unilaterally. Puerto Rico could petition, it could request reforms, but final decisions rested elsewhere. This was power without proximity. We should be clear about something else. There was no mass referendum approving this transfer. There was no collective moment of consent. Puerto Rico did not choose the United States. The United States chose Puerto Rico. That distinction matters because it shaped everything that followed. From this moment forward, every debate about rights, representation, and responsibility would run into the same wall. Who decides? And on what basis? The island's economy began to adjust to its new role. Trade routes were redirected. Agricultural priorities shifted. The mainland market became dominant. This was presented as integration, but it also increased dependency. Puerto Rico was being positioned inside an economic system it did not control. Culturally, the pressure was immediate. Language policy in schools changed. Symbols of authority shifted. The island's identity was not erased, but it was challenged. Puerto Ricans were expected to adapt quickly to a system that had not adapted to them at all. Resistance existed, but it was constrained. Organizing under military rule was risky. Protest carried consequences. The message from the new administration was clear. Order came first. Questions about sovereignty could wait, but they did not disappear. Beneath the surface, a deeper realization was taking hold. The end of Spanish rule had not delivered self-determination. It had replaced one distant ruler with another. The vocabulary had changed. The structure had not. We say this plainly because history often softens this moment. It talks about transition. It talks about modernization. It avoids the word colony. But power tells the truth through behavior, not labels. Puerto Rico could not decide its political future. It could not reject federal authority. It could not negotiate as an equal. That is the definition of colonial control, regardless of how benevolent it is framed. As the island moved into the new century, it did so without clarity, without consent, and without control. The questions left unanswered in 1898 did not fade. They hardened. And the most dangerous question of all began to form, quietly, without resolution. If Puerto Rico was not free and not fully equal, then what exactly was it supposed to become? Chapter 2. Citizenship without consent. The question did not go away after the transfer. It deepened. If Puerto Rico now belonged to the United States, then what did that make the people who lived there? Subjects, nationals, future citizens, or something else entirely? For nearly two decades after 1898, the answer remained unclear. Puerto Ricans were governed by federal authority, but they were not recognized as citizens of the country that ruled them. They owed allegiance. They followed federal law. But they did not possess the political standing that usually came with that obligation. This uncertainty was not accidental. It gave Congress flexibility. By avoiding a clear status, lawmakers preserved full control over the island while postponing hard decisions about rights and representation. In 1917, that ambiguity narrowed. The United States extended citizenship to Puerto Ricans through federal law. It was not the result of a binding island-wide vote. It was not negotiated. It was announced. Citizenship arrived by statute, not by consent. This moment is often described as inclusion. But inclusion usually involves choice. In Puerto Rico's case, citizenship was assigned. The island did not vote on whether it wanted this status. It was informed that it now had it. At the same time, the limits of that citizenship were immediately clear. Puerto Ricans could not vote for the president who enforced federal law over the island. They could not elect voting representatives to Congress, the body that controlled their budget, trade rules, and political framework. Federal courts had authority. Federal agencies had authority. Local power stopped short of the final say. This created a condition that was legally precise and politically unstable. Puerto Ricans were citizens in obligation, but incomplete in power. Military service made this contradiction impossible to ignore. Puerto Ricans were eligible for the draft. They could be sent to fight in wars decided by leaders they did not elect. The burden of citizenship was enforced. The benefits were limited. We need to say this carefully. This was not an oversight. It was a structure. Congress retained the authority to overrule local laws. It controlled trade. It controlled currency. It controlled borders. The local government existed, but only within boundaries drawn elsewhere. autonomy was conditional and revocable. For everyday life on the island, this had real consequences. Wages were shaped by federal economic policy. Labor conditions followed rules set off island. Trade laws favored mainland shipping interests. These decisions were justified as national policy, even though the nation did not fully recognize Puerto Rico as an equal participant. Migration increased as a result. Economic pressure pushed many Puerto Ricans to the mainland in search of opportunity. This movement was often framed as freedom of movement within a single country, but it was also a release valve for a system that limited economic growth on the island itself. Those who left gained voting rights they could not access at home. Those who stayed remained governed without full voice. The local political structure tried to navigate this reality. Elections were held. Parties formed around different visions of the future. Some pushed for statehood, others for independence. Some argued for enhanced autonomy within the existing framework. But every option ran into the same barrier. Final authority rested with Congress. Even when island leaders reached internal consensus, implementation required federal approval. The island could express preference. It could not enforce outcome. This bred frustration, but also fatigue. Debates over status became cyclical. Promises were made. Studies were commissioned. Commissions reported. Nothing fundamental changed. The language of citizenship softened public discussion, but it did not resolve the imbalance. Many were told they were Americans when it came to obligation, but reminded they were something else when it came to power. Culturally, this tension seeped into identity. Puerto Ricans were expected to pledge loyalty to a flag that did not fully recognize their voice. At the same time, they were encouraged to preserve a distinct culture that marked them as separate. Inclusion and separation existed side by side. We should not underestimate the psychological weight of this condition. Being governed without full participation erodes trust, it reshapes expectations, it teaches people to adapt rather than decide. By the mid-20th century, Puerto Rico was deeply integrated into the United States system, yet structurally excluded from its core democratic mechanisms. This was not temporary. It was normalized. And normalization is powerful. When generations grow up under limited sovereignty, the absence of power begins to feel ordinary, not acceptable, but expected. The question shifts from why is this happening to how do we survive within it? This is the quiet danger of partial citizenship. It does not arrive with chains, it arrives with paperwork. Puerto Rico was now bound tightly to the United States, but without the tools to shape that bond on equal terms. Citizenship had been granted, power had not. As the island moved forward, the unresolved contradiction remained at its center. If citizenship did not bring consent, representation, or control, then what purpose did it serve? That question did not stay abstract for long. Chapter 3. Owned in the modern age. The limits of Puerto Rico's power were always present. They became impossible to ignore when pressure arrived all at once. By the early 21st century, the island was carrying the weight of decisions made far beyond its borders. Economic policy, trade rules, and fiscal constraints had accumulated over decades. Growth slowed, public services strained, jobs disappeared faster than they could be replaced. Migration increased again, not as choice, but as necessity. When collapse came, it did not arrive as a single event. It unfolded, quietly at first, then all at once. Puerto Rico could not restructure its obligations the way a sovereign nation could. It could not control its monetary policy. It could not negotiate freely with creditors. Its elected leaders faced limits that were legal, not optional. Authority ended where federal law began. The response exposed the reality of the relationship. A federal control structure was imposed with the power to override local decisions. Budgets were rewritten, services were cut, priorities were set outside the island. The local government remained, but it no longer held the final word over its own finances. This was not presented as punishment, it was framed as responsibility, as necessity, as rescue. But rescue without consent looks a lot like control. Puerto Ricans watched as unelected overseers made decisions that reshaped daily life. Schools closed, hospitals consolidated, communities were told these sacrifices were unavoidable. Democracy, once limited, was now openly suspended in critical areas. Then disaster struck. When hurricanes tore through the island, they did more than damage infrastructure. They stripped away the last illusions of autonomy, Power grids failed, communication collapsed, aid was delayed, coordination faltered. The response revealed a hard truth. When crisis hit, Puerto Rico could not command urgency from the system that governed it. The island waited, federal officials debated, supplies moved slowly, promises were made, then revised. The language of citizenship did not translate into equal protection. The gap between responsibility and authority became visible to the world. For many Puerto Ricans, this was the breaking point. Not because disaster happens everywhere, but because the response confirmed what had long been suspected. Puerto Rico did not control its fate in moments that mattered most. The debate over political status surged again. Statehood, independence, continuation of the current arrangement. Each option carried risk. Each came with trade-offs. None offered an immediate exit from uncertainty. Votes were held. Preferences were expressed. Results were debated. But binding resolution remained out of reach. Congress retained the final say, and Congress did not act. This is where powerlessness becomes corrosive. When participation is allowed but outcome is withheld, people disengage. Trust erodes. Cynicism grows. The question stops being what should we choose and becomes does our choice matter? Generations have now grown up under this condition. They know how to navigate federal systems. They know how to adapt. They know how to leave. What they have not been allowed to do is decide. We speak here not to assign blame to individuals, but to describe a system that asks for loyalty without offering authority, that demands compliance without granting control, that frames restraint as partnership. Puerto Rico exists in a permanent in-between, not foreign enough to be free, not equal enough to be sovereign within the Union, governed by laws it cannot fully shape, dependent on responses it cannot command. This is not a failure of character or capacity. It is the outcome of structure. And structures endure when they are left unresolved. The danger now is not just economic or political. It is historical. When powerlessness persists long enough, it reshapes identity. People stop expecting agency. They learn to survive within limitation. They internalize the idea that decisions will always be made elsewhere. That is the quiet cost of a colony without end. Puerto Rico has resisted in many ways, through culture, through language, through community, through migration and return, through insistence that identity cannot be legislated away. But resistance is not the same as resolution. The question that opened in 1898 remains unanswered. Who decides Puerto Rico's future? Until that question is resolved, powerlessness is not a phase, it is policy. And policies do not fade with time. They harden.